This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. Today I want to talk about notions of social mobility and this often hard to define idea of the American dream in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War. As we know, before the Second World War, really up to 1940, America had found it more difficult than any other advanced nation in the world to shake off the Great Depression. The memories of economic crisis and depression were writ large in the American psyche, and there were all sorts of acute anxieties at the end of the Second World War that America might indeed go back into depression. The standards of living that American people achieved in the mid to late 1940s were significantly higher than war-ravaged Europe and bankrupt Great Britain. And there was a belief that America had managed somehow to buck the trend of 20th century history, which was up until that point a crisis. America represented to the GIs returning a land of opportunity. It very much depended on whether you're black or white, of course. And with the massive state intervention of the GI Bill and other huge areas of state spending, there was perfect conditions for economic boom. Not only had America captured world markets during the war and competitors had been eliminated for at least one, if not two, generations, particularly Germany and Japan, but also the fading powers of the British and the French were going to open up vistas of opportunity to America hitherto unforeseen. In the late 1940s, there's a widespread belief in the American dream, in that the American dream, I suppose, one can refer to really as social and economic mobility. Americans in the late 40s did earn more than their parents' generation had on the whole. Life expectancy had increased, life and opportunities were more plentiful, there was greater availability of food, of healthcare, the living conditions overall for most Americans had improved, and so had wages and the opportunity to save and invest. By 1945, total personal savings for Americans were $140 billion. Beyond the simple kind of rags-to-riches fantasies that really not a great deal of people ever really entertain, there was an overall sense of well-being, of a society that was improving in prosperity and that was socially cohesive. It wasn't a society that was deeply egalitarian. It was a society that was that believed itself to be meritocratic. It was a society that believed the narrative that hard work and ingenuity and effort would eventually pay off and be rewarded, and that each by his own efforts would succeed. And the belief that there was a meritocratic society was in some ways incompatible with, but at sometimes coexisted with, the existence of clearly stratified society based on strong notions of hierarchy and social class. And it would be this abundance, this material wealth, that would start to change the nature of work in the post-war era. The idea that work was simply labour in order to fund a lifestyle or a subsistence in some cases, in the 50s, 60s and 70s would eventually become replaced for vast swathes of the population by the notion that work was about vocation, about career, about satisfaction, about the expression of self. This had all normally been the preserve of a very lucky few. This becomes part of the experience of an entire population in the post-war era in America, and becomes embedded with in ideas of popular culture. And this perhaps explains how by the 1970s and then 1980s you get a much more individualistic culture, a much more some might even say narcissistic culture, based around notions of the self. But in its essence, this faith in the American dream was another iteration of the ideas of the American Revolution, when supposedly fundamental change happened when the British were removed and the rule of King George the Third was ended. The reality is that there was no particular social revolution to accompany the War of Independence, but ideas of equality and social betterment were given fertile breeding ground in America, even if in the reality, since the late 18th century, was that in many instances they didn't take root. They were able to take root in the post-war era in a kind of a brief historical window between the 40s and the 70s, because there was the material abundance for them to be able to do so. This window probably closed in the late 1970s, or began to close in the late 1970s, after a decade of oil shocks, inflation, rising unemployment and social crisis. And the dream, or the desire, or the persistent belief that it is an age that will return has not left America or American society ever since. You can probably find versions of this in most other first world countries. Certainly most of Europe experienced radical improvement in living circumstances in the 50s to the 70s, and there has been a kind of what Tony Judd in his book Postwar describes as the era of the recessional from the 70s through to the 90s, and this era of diminished expectations as people look back fondly on this, what we Western societies collectively see as a kind of rather mythical golden age of material well-being. Famously, in sort of popular narratives about America and the America of the 20th century, it is the energy of immigrants that brings around so much prosperity. And the prosperity was particularly enjoyed, as previously mentioned, by the white suburban middle classes of America, because they were the ones who enjoyed the mainstay of political and social and civil rights. They had the benefits of political representation that black and other ethnic minorities didn't. And the combination of a boom in material living standards, along with adequate political representation, and a sense that one's own social group owns this society and is the dominant force within this society, led to a sense of optimism and a sense of positivity that probably wasn't shared by people from ethnic minorities who were not benefiting in quite the same ways. And this segregation of opportunity was something that would store up deep resentments through the 1940s and 50s and be one of the powering forces of the civil rights movement. Of course, black soldiers fought in the Second World War with just the level of courage and sacrifice that their white counterparts did, even though a great many were actually kept out of frontline service. They still returned with a sense that they had overthrown fascism and Japanese imperialism. And it was these sacrifices that black Americans believed entitled them to a share of the prosperous post-war America that was now emerging. Not only had they fought on everywhere from Normandy to the Pacific, but also black Americans had worked in the munitions industries and the shipbuilding industries and the aircraft industries and all the other vital war production that had made America the arsenal of the world. Part of the new era of social optimism was based around home ownership. Between the 1940s and the 1970s, 20% of Americans changed home every year, just to give you an example of the amount of economic activity that was invested within the property market. So overall, despite the fact that social mobility wasn't a given for all people, and that in many cases there were Americans who didn't change their circumstances from one generation to the next, the fact that there was a widespread belief that this was possible counts for an awful lot. This shapes the optimism of post-war America, and it makes the idea that America was a society that was worth sacrificing for and fighting for and defending against external threats such as communism a very compelling one. Science and technology and the notion of progress through science and through the better understanding of the laws of the universe and of nature and of physics and the ability through the use of science and engineering to exploit the natural world was also part of the optimistic view of this era.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
So science and technology in general, even though the workings of much of it were a mystery to many Americans, was established in popular consciousness as being a source of great power and force and a force for good by the war. Not only had science and technology been employed to fight the war in ways that have hitherto been unimagined, but the war had been ended by atomic power. The dropping of the two atomic bombs on Hiroshima was seen, had a kind of widespread public approval, and was seen as being ultimately something that was justified, and that had brought the war to an end before many, many more people, particularly hundreds of thousands of American soldiers, would have had to have died seizing the Japanese home islands. This was seen as a sacrifice worth making. The bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki raised few objections in post-war America. Popular culture represented or echoed a fascination with all things atomic. The revelation that the inner workings of atoms, the building blocks of the universe, were capable of rendering immense power and energy was a huge and hugely fascinating and compelling notion in an era where much of the kind of the advances in science since the beginning of the 20th century are widespread, were kind of fairly poorly understood. Medicine and the idea that there were panaceas now available to all diseases could be cured through antibiotics and other now easily available and manufacturable pharmaceuticals, was again becomes almost a kind of like an article of faith. It enables all conditions to be medicalized and treated medically, and this has profound implications for psychiatry and for the treatment of mentally ill people through psychotherapy, and the idea that doctors and institutions particularly were capable of fixing particularly the mentally ill through the latest psychiatric or pharmacological interventions. The reality, of course, is that individuals who wound up in this system often found themselves robbed of any agency, robbed of any rights, as you know, Ken Kesey's "One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest" would tend to suggest. So overall, there is a kind of a deep faith in progress, a notion that progress is possible. It's a notion that in our times we might look back on and see as being naive or questionable, But we don't exist within the same historical context. And most of our kind of discourses, our ideas about what is true, what is not, what is possible, what is not, are socially constructed. And they are based within the set of economic and social relations that exist at the time. So it's kind of easy for us to scoff about this kind of Jetson's vision of the future. But the reality is that our discourses are historically specific. Of course, people would believe these kinds of things at the time. And to some extent, they were right. Up until the point where they're not. In education, there was a clear evidence of this faith in the idea of endless vistas of progress. The public school system within America had been an institution of mixed success prior to the war. By 1940, for example, only a third of the 74.8 million American adults who were 25 years or over had gone to school beyond the 8th grade. Only a quarter were high school graduates. One-twelfth graduated from four-year colleges or from universities. Teenagers at that time were staying in school longer than their elders had, but only 49% of 17-year-olds graduated from high school. And this is there are far worse stats when you look at black children in southern states who are learning in poorly financed institutions, and they were being taught by poorly paid and poorly trained teachers, some teachers who were earning less than $600 a year. The war doesn't change all that much. Wartime interruptions meant that a slightly smaller cohort of 17-year-olds graduated from high school in 1946 than had done before the war began. But there were 350,000 teachers had left their jobs to fight in the war or work in other fields. And the US in general, by 1940, was spending a smaller proportion of national income on schools than Britain or the Soviet Union. By 1945, by the end of the war, the morale of the teaching profession was at an all-time low, and by 1946 there were strikes planned on a scale that had never been seen in America before. There were significant changes, however, to education from 1944 onwards with the GI Bill of Rights. This was a very broad piece of legislation. It not only did it offer finance to veterans to offer them homes to return to at almost zero interest loans and to set up businesses, but it also gave the opportunity to veterans who wanted to educate themselves. So veterans would be given $65 a month for single veterans and $90 for those with children or partners, and the maximum would be of $500 a year would be given for tuition and books. So there was a significant sum of money at the time. And this affects an entire generation of men returning from the war, and has a massive knock-on effect throughout the post-war era. These are, for the most part, relatively young men returning home who have many years life in America ahead of them. The GI program runs till 1956. 7.8 million veterans, which were half of all who'd served, had taken part. 2.2 million went to college, 3.5 million to technical schools, below college level, and 700,000 went to agricultural college and worked on, trained on farms. $14.5 billion was injected into the education system between 1944 and 1956, and this led to an educational boom. There were waves of men who went into colleges and schools and universities. Some were actually overwhelmed by the number of subscriptions for their courses. And of course, all these institutions suddenly found huge inflows of cash into their coffers. And the culture of many colleges and universities began to dramatically change. Many had been used to dealing with the upper middle classes, who were the only people who could previously afford to go to university, and upper middle class, mainly men, who had come with pre-prepared with a set of cultural and political and social assumptions. And now there were wave after wave of mainly working or lower middle class students who had already had the life experience of going to war, who had all sorts of technical skills, knowledge, know-how and experience, and who were probably not going to be taught or dealt with in quite the same way. Many took up vocational or business related courses and wanted things that would be practical for them to develop their lives in post-war America. And it was an enormous boon to America's post-war economy, one of the most strategically long-lasting and important and influential and significant acts that the American government took in the post-war era. It provided, as I said, generations of Americans with the skills to become significant actors within the economy. However, much of this was segregated. It predominantly and overwhelmingly benefited white Americans, and black Americans were almost exclusively marginalised from the GI Bill. Overall, between 1944 and 1950, spending per pupil, not GI returning GIs, but normal high school students, doubled. And the increase of students graduating from high school was remarkable. By 1970, for example, 75.6% of 17-year-olds were graduating, and 48% of 18-year-olds were enrolling in a college or a university. So America in the post-war era became a society for which education became far more a central part of American life than it had been previously in the pre-war years. Anyway, I hope you found this useful and interesting, and I'll be back later on, hopefully this week, with another instalment of the podcast. Stop by our Facebook group if you can. There's also always an interesting chat going on there, and it'd be great to know what you've made of this podcast on the American Dream. So give us your views, and we'll catch up soon. Thanks, all the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.